Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Now, if you've ever tried to get your head around the term post-colonialism, you might have found yourself, well, wading through some pretty dense academic stuff.
Yeah, it can feel a bit distant, maybe historical, even a little dry sometimes.
Exactly. But today, we're kind of tearing down those ivory tower walls. We're diving into Robert Young's essential introduction to the subject.
And it's a really important one.
It really is.
Yeah.
Trust me, it reveals a topic that is fiercely political, incredibly urgent, and absolutely shapes our modern world.
That's really the mission here, isn't it? And it's crucial. We're following Young's own approach, basically, reclaiming post-colonialism from just being, you know, an academic buzzword,
right,
and connecting it back to where it actually came from, the radical, political, revolutionary, anti-colonial movements.
And the timing feels so relevant now. Young's work gives us this critical framework, like right now, to analyze the persistent legacies of colonialism.
These aren't just dusty history lessons.
No, not at all. These are like the hidden wires that shape everything. Global economic inequality, those big trade deals you hear about, even deep issues of cultural identity and, you know, how we even decide whose history or whose knowledge actually counts.
So who's our guide through all this? The scholar leading the charge.
Our guide is Robert J.C. Young. He's a really distinguished figure, currently the Julius Silver Professor at NYU. Foundational, really, in post-colonial studies.
Okay. And what makes his take on it so, let's say, trustworthy or unique?
Well, what makes his perspective so powerful, I think, is that he just refuses to keep theory and history locked in separate boxes. He's not just looking at the complex ideas of thinkers like, say, Edward Said or Gayatri Spivak in isolation.
Right.
He actively bridges that theory with the material history, the actual, often brutal political practice of anti-colonial resistance.
Yeah, that grounding is key. He connects the theory back to the lived experience of struggle, drawing on figures like Frantz Fanon, Amilcar Cabral, real revolutionaries.
Exactly.
And this is crucial. He presents the whole field, not as some static subject you just study, but as a living, breathing tradition of radical thought. It's like an intellectual inheritance directly from those struggles.
Okay, let's get to the core idea of the book, because Young's main argument really shifts how we think about the word post-colonialism. He's emphatic. It's not just the period after colonialism supposedly ended.
Right. If you only think chronologically, like post meaning after, you miss the entire point.
So what is it then?
It's an ongoing, active political project rooted really deep in the history of resistance. It's more like a continuation of the fight for liberation, not some neat conclusion.
That makes sense. And the way the book is structured really drives this home, doesn't it? It kind of forces you, the listener, to face that political struggle first.
It does. He moves chronologically. Starting with the sheer violence of colonialism, but then he pivots hard to the liberation movements themselves.
And he does something quite unique.
Yeah.
He centers the Tricontinental Alliance as the real birthplace of post-colonial thought, before he even gets to the academic theorists we usually associate with the term.
Exactly. It's a deliberate flip. So the book's analysis works on three levels. The history of colonial violence, then the history of resistance against it, and then the development of post-colonial theory as like an intellectual extension of that resistance. It's all designed to make sure we understand how that colonial past is still actively shaping, well, pretty much everything in our present.
So to start that journey, Young really makes us confront the foundational violence of the whole system. Colonialism, he says, was this systematic project.
Yeah.
Driven by economics, right? Extraction, captive markets.
Yeah, stealing resources, forcing people to buy your goods.
Yeah.
But it needed an ideological justification, that myth of the civilizing mission.
Right, the cover story.
But the real depth of control, and this is where post-colonial thought really has to start, went way beyond just soldiers or economics. Young introduces this concept of epistemic violence.
Epistemic violence.
Right.
Sounds intense. What does that actually mean in practice? How is destroying knowledge a form of violence?
Well, yeah, think about it like this. It wasn't just, say, burning libraries or imposing foreign laws, though that happened too. It was the systematic eradication of indigenous knowledge.
How so?
By, for example, forcing indigenous languages out of schools, out of government, cutting people off from their own history, their traditional science, their medicine, their spiritual understanding of the world.
Wow.
Colonialism basically tried to replace all that wholesale convincing the colonized that their own ways of knowing were invalid, primitive, or maybe didn't even exist.
Yeah.
That systematic erasure, that disconnection, that's the intellectual subjugation post-colonial thought tries to undo.
Okay, so the fight back then has to be about mental liberation just as much as political freedom, which brings us right to the political heart of Young's argument, the anti-colonial struggle itself.
Absolutely. And Young's core point is worth repeating. Post-colonialism starts with anti-colonialism. It's the continuation. And for him, the absolute defining moment, the crucible, was the 1966 Tricontinental Conference in Havana, Cuba.
Okay, why that specific event? What was so significant about Havana in 66?
Because this was where revolutionary delegates from across Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the emerging nations of what they termed the Third World, actually came together.
Right.
It was this incredible forging of political, intellectual, even military solidarity against imperialism and the beginnings of neocolonialism. This alliance cemented the Third World not just as a place on the map, but as a unified political and intellectual force.
I see.
And that political movement is absolutely central to Young's thesis. Post-colonialism is, first and foremost, a global liberation project born from that kind of revolutionary cooperation.
It's only after establishing that political bedrock, that history of resistance, that Young brings in the key thinkers who then formalize the theory, building on that groundwork. These are the names maybe more familiar to people.
Yes. Starting with probably the most well-known, Edward Said, his huge work, Orientalism. Mm-hmm. It basically showed us exactly how that epistemic violence works in practice.
How so?
Said demonstrated how the West systematically produced biased knowledge, a whole discourse, he called it about the Orient, portraying it as exotic, irrational, dangerous, you name it, all to justify colonial rule. Knowledge is power.
Okay, knowledge is power. Can you give a quick example? Like, how could a travel book or a stereotype actually help justify invading somewhere?
Well, yeah, Young points out that if Western writers and academics constantly describe people in, say, the Middle East or India as inherently lazy or childlike or unable to govern themselves, that provided the perfect moral and intellectual excuse for colonial powers to step in, claiming they were bringing order or progress. The biased knowledge came first, making the invasion seem almost inevitable, maybe even benevolent to the colonizers.
That's chillingly effective. Okay, moving on, there's Gayatri Spivak. You mentioned she brings in an ethical dimension.
Spivak really pushes us to look at the deepest margins, the voices erased not just by the colonizers, but sometimes even within the nationalist movements themselves. She focuses particularly on marginalized women, the rural poor, the truly voiceless.
And her famous question.
Her crucial, really difficult question, can the subaltern speak? It forces us to ask if those at the very bottom of the social ladder can ever truly represent themselves, or are they always spoken for? It demands we think about whose voices get heard and whose gets silenced, even when we think we're fighting for justice.
Hmm. A vital ethical check. And then there's Homi K. Bhabha, who looks at the messy cultural results using terms like hybridity and mimicry.
Right. Bhabha dives into those complex zones where cultures collide and mix under colonial rule. He looks at how colonial power isn't always straightforward. It often creates these weird contradictory effects.
Like mimicry.
Yeah. He argues that when the colonized try to mimic the colonizer, maybe adopting their language, dress, or manners to get ahead in the system, that act of copying can actually expose the absurdity and shakiness of the colonizer's authority. It's never a perfect copy.
Interesting.
And this leads to hybridity, new mixed cultural forms emerging in that space between cultures. Bhabha sees this hybridity not as something weak, but as a creative force that actually subverts the rigid power structures from within.
Okay, this connects directly to our world now. Chapters 5 and 8 in Young's book link this history to the present through neocolonialism and globalization. Define neocolonialism in this context.
Neocolonialism is basically the dominant structure after formal independence. It's the situation where former colonies are politically independent. You know, they have a flag, a seat at the UN, but they remain economically, culturally, and structurally dependent on their former colonizers or other global powers.
So independence on paper, but not really in practice.
Essentially, yeah. Political freedom, but economic chains.
And Young's argument is that globalization, far from being some neutral force, is actually the latest phase of that same imperial project.
Precisely. He argues that the same old patterns of resource extraction, exploitation, and unequal exchange continue, but now they're embedded within global institutions. He looks closely at organizations like the IMF and the World Bank.
How do they fit in?
Well, He argues that the loans they offer often come with strings-attached policies like forced privatization, cutting public spending, structural adjustment, which tend to benefit corporations in the global north and trap countries in the global south in cycles of debt and dependency. It basically recreates the old colonial economic relationship just through finance and policy instead of direct rule.
Okay, that's a lot to take in. Let's try and boil this down. What are, say, four core takeaways that you, the listener, can really hold on to? First, post-colonialism is political practice.
Yeah, this is absolutely central to Young's whole project. This isn't just abstract theory. It's a set of ideas, a toolkit, derived directly from those revolutionary struggles we talked about.
So the takeaway is?
So when you see maybe an autonomy movement fighting for control over their resources, or a political struggle against unfair trade deals in the global south, recognize that as part of this ongoing intellectual and political project of liberation. It's theory in action.
Got it. Second big theme. The enduring legacy of colonialism. Young hammers home that these colonial structures aren't just history. They're alive and kicking, woven into the fabric of today's world.
Right. So you can use this lens to understand current events better. If you see a country dealing with ongoing political instability or maybe deep ethnic conflicts, or crushing economic dependency decades after independence,
yeah,
the post-colonial perspective helps you see the historical roots, understand why those problems are so deep-seated and structural, often tracing back to colonial policies or borders.
Makes sense. Third takeaway, hybridity as a force of creativity. That mixing of cultures, which colonizers often saw as a problem, is actually a source of strength.
Exactly. It's what Pabha called that third space. It challenges the rigid us versus them thinking that colonialism relied on.
And the reflection for us.
The reflection is powerful. Maybe embrace complexity. Recognize that mixed identities, whether cultural, racial, national, aren't a witness, but a potentially powerful, creative position that resists being easily categorized or controlled.
I like that. And finally, the crucial ongoing work, decolonizing the mind.
Mm-hmm. This is about recognizing that true liberation isn't just political. It involves actively challenging the Western-centric viewpoints and narratives that still dominate so much of our media, our education, even our ideas about what progress looks like.
So it's about questioning assumptions.
Yes, and actively recovering or valuing those other ways of knowing, those indigenous knowledge systems that epistemic violence tried to erase. It's a continual process.
Young's book, as you'd expect, has some really memorable ways of putting things. Let's maybe highlight a few core statements that really capture the essence of this deep dive.
Okay. The first one really sums up his whole mission. Post-colonialism is not simply a theory you read in a book. It is the theoretical elaboration of the political practices of anti-colonial liberation movements.
Right. It just reinforces it perfectly. Theory follows action. The ideas emerge from the struggle. The scholar just helps articulate them.
Exactly. Then there's a statement that gets at the subtle power of ideological control. The power of colonialism was not just in its armies and its laws, but in its ability to control history and knowledge, to create a truth about the world in which the West was superior.
That's basically the definition of epistemic violence in practice, isn't it? It shows that fighting back means fighting against those imposed stories, those constructed hierarchies.
Mm-hmm. And finally, drawing on Spivak, that vital ethical reminder, the crucial question of post-colonial ethics posed by Spivak is, can the subaltern speak? And can we listen without speaking for them?
Yeah, that's such a powerful challenge to us all. It forces you to constantly check your own position, right? To make sure that in any conversation about power or inequality, the most marginalized aren't just being represented by others, but are genuinely empowered to speak for themselves. And crucially, that we're actually listening.
So thinking practically, how can we actually integrate some of this into our everyday lives? Let's start with, say, how we consume media.
Okay. Well, you can apply that Orientalism lens Edward Say gave us constantly. When you're watching the news about another part of the world or a documentary, ask yourself, how are these people being shown?
Are they just exotic background? Are they portrayed as inherently dangerous? Or just passive victims waiting for Western help.
Right. Questioning that framing, even just internally, can lead you to a much more nuanced and less biased understanding of what's actually going on.
Or think about global economics. When you hear discussions about international debt or big trade agreements, bring in that concept of neocolonialism.
Don't just assume it's all neutral and technical.
Exactly. Ask, how might this deal actually reinforce dependency? Who really benefits? Does it help the country become more autonomous, or does it lock them further into a system that benefits the global north?
That's a good point. And if you travel, This knowledge can inform ethical travel.
Right, definitely. Move beyond just consuming the exotic as a spectacle. Be aware of the power dynamics that are often inherent in tourism.
Yeah.
Try to seek out and prioritize local voices, local businesses, local perspectives for a more respectful and meaningful exchange.
Okay. And finally, bringing it home, applying the concept of the subaltern to maybe local social justice work.
Yeah, absolutely. In any movement or organization you're involved with, consciously ask, are the voices of the most marginalized those facing complex intersections of, say, class, race, gender, disability, actually being centered and heard?
Or are they being spoken for by people with more privilege?
Exactly. It's about ensuring genuine inclusion and empowerment, not just representation by proxy.
You know, this has been incredibly eye-opening. For me, what was genuinely surprising, or maybe clarifying, was Young's deliberate political framing, anchoring post-colonialism so firmly in the history of the Tricontinental Alliance.
Shifting it away from just literary theory.
Yeah. It makes the whole field feel less like, you know, a subject you study for an exam,
yeah,
and much more like reading a guide to an ongoing global revolution. It feels active.
That's a great way to put it. For me, the lasting insight, the thing that really sticks, is Young's relentless insistence that the past isn't dead. It's not even past, as Faulkner said.
Right.
These colonial structures, these ways of thinking, they're still active systems that we navigate and often participate in every single day. And the biggest takeaway from that is that real liberation isn't just about changing governments or economies. Mm. It demands this constant, lifelong commitment to what he calls the decolonization of the mind.
A challenging but vital thought to end on.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.